please help me welcome Greg from Culpepper.
All right. There's usually never this many people here. Oh, so I was talking to Rich on the way down here. I told Sam too. Bummy always says whenever he gives a talk, there's always three talks. There's the one he's going to give on the ride to the meeting, the one he gives when he's at the meeting, and then the one he should have given on the ride home. I can definitely identify with that. Anytime I've told my story or spoke in AA, I always feel the same way, and I always start off a little nervous. And but I tell you, I was looking around the room, you know, whenever you speak in a room full of people, that most of whom you know very well, it certainly is a little bit different than driving out of town or something to speak for a group of strangers. So I definitely feel like I'm at home here, and I appreciate Billy's not here, but I appreciate Billy and the group for having me up to share. I'll try to share my experience, strength, and hope with you guys in a general way, and I hope you all get something out of it. So just to start off, I have a sobriety date. That's an important fact. September 1st, 2001, and I have a sponsor, happens to be here tonight, just in case I divert from the truth. And another good thing about, I was sitting here thinking this, having people that know you well, speaking to people that know you very well, I have to really keep it grounded in the truth, because many of the people in this room are part of my sobriety in some way or another, you know, or know me. And spend time together in meetings. So, I grew up in Culpepper and a pretty normal family. It's myself, mom, dad, and a sister. And, you know, nothing out of the ordinary to earth shattering happened growing up to me as a child. I was talking to somebody. I think we were here and we were talking about, doesn't matter what we're talking about, but I know growing up as a child, I always had to be the center of attention. I always wanted to be the class clown. I was always the guy who got in trouble at school, put his name on the board, or get sent to the principal's office. And in the early beginnings, I remember getting my hand slapped with a ruler, you know, or get a whipping in school. And, you know, for some reason, it never really fazed me. It never influenced me in any way, really, shape, or form, other than it gave me the idea that I needed to be a little bit, you know, more sly about how I conduct my business. You know, if you're going to act up, you don't get caught. You know, that was the lesson to that. And, I mean, I used to get whippings as a child, and it certainly never stopped me from doing the things I wasn't supposed to be doing. So I guess I say that because I certainly don't hold my parents accountable or responsible for my alcoholism. I don't, you know, I don't blame anything that happened to me in life that made me alcoholic. I do have a lot of photographs. One grandfather passed away before I remember. I was about three, and I have a lot of photographs of him with his head down on the kitchen table with a glass and a half-smoked cigar next to him on the table, you know. So that's kind of was my memory of him. I never actually had a memory. It's just what I've seen in these photos. And another grandfather who was verbally and maybe sometimes also physically abusive to my grandmother, I did have a vague memory of that. And I just kind of played it off to, he was a veteran of World War II. Purple Heart recipient, veteran, and he, I always played it off too, and I think my mother and father played it off too, that he just had a really rough time with that whole experience, and, you know, they played it off. Yeah, he was a good man, but he was a little, you know, he drank too much and he became verbally and sometimes physically abusive. So I didn't know a whole lot about that. They, both passed away, probably before I was 10 years old, so. I didn't have a whole lot of didn't have a whole lot of illustrations of people that were actively alcoholic in my life. It wasn't real commonly around me. I had an uncle that liked to drink a lot, and him and his buddies, he was my good time uncle, you know, him and his buddies, they would have parties, they'd do crab boils, cookouts, and, you know, have a band out there. And I remember, you know, vague memories, you know, 6, 7, 10 years old, you know, running around, playing with other kids, and, you know, they're sitting at the table, you know, surrounded by crabs and beer cans, you know, for all day long or hours on end. And I remember I was always intrigued by, he always had this bottle of liquid in the freezer, but it wouldn't freeze. And it was clear. And I was like, you know, I always used to look at that and wonder. And it was his freezer. It was his refrigerator, his freezer down behind his bar. And you know, my aunt told me stay out of there. You know, that's his freezer, so his refrigerator. So I used to sneak down there and investigate things and play with that bottle and rock it back and forth and watch the clear unfrozen liquid in there. And that was sort of foreshadowing of things to come in my own future. And I remember it's the biggest supply of liquor I think I had ever seen as a child. I remember having a few drinks, maybe a few sips of wine or something at a party. My parents would go to a Super Bowl party or something like that, and I remember as a child, you know, asking for a sip of wine just out of curiosity or something like that. I don't remember anything too memorable about those experiences, just that I had them. But I remember I stole some beer from my uncle's supply. I mean, he had enough. He certainly didn't miss the few I took. And I was pretty young. I don't know. It was 10 or 11. And maybe I told my sister or something. I think maybe we tried one or two, and I don't think it really worked for me. You know, I was too young to really understand what I was supposed to do with it. But then somewhere about, 12 years old, I had an older cousin from Missouri came to stay with us for the summer. And he was 21. I think he was 21 or 22. And he was pretty cool, you know, because he had a car, and he played rock and roll real loud, you know, and he would go party and things like that. And he came to stay with us for the summer, and I remember I convinced me and two friends, we convinced him to buy us a case of Milwaukee's Best. And we waited. It seemed like my parents would never go to sleep that night. And we waited, and we waited, and we waited, and finally they went to bed, and we consumed that case, and it seemed like a matter of minutes, but we just got those little cups out, and we just filling them and drinking them, you know, no reserve to it whatsoever. And I remember at the end of the night, that was the first time I really got drunk, and that was the first time I blacked out also. And I had one friend was in the toilet, you know, throwing up by the end of the night. And the other guy was with me, had passed out. He had fallen asleep. And I was just running around the house, wired up, you know, like I was crazy, you know. And, you know, they were at the end of it all. We compared notes, you know, the following morning or next day or whatever. And they were like, wow, that's crazy, you know. Didn't seem that interested, but I was thinking to myself, I won't do that again, you know, and soon, you know. So I sort of became, I had an older sister, so I would try to hang out with her friends too. That kind of started that whole summer, I was exposed to a lot of things with the older cousin, and then I kind of became aware of this other world of existence and what grown-up folks do, you know, and so I kind of pursued that lifestyle as best I could as a 13-year-old person, and I don't know, there was a bunch of other experiences that summer, too. I think it was the summer, I don't know if I was a little bit younger, I think it was the summer I was going in seventh grade, and I remember by the time I was in, say, eighth grade, I was like a full-blown weekend warrior, you know what I mean? I live for the social life of the weekend, you know, and I used to had this wooded piece of property behind my house and have friends over, and we'd, you know, convince somebody to buy something and or do something else, you know, not drinking, some other dry alcohol, and we'd go back in the woods there, and we'd hang out back there for days, it seemed like, and we just, for about a couple years, that was regular. By the time I was about 15, I had progressed, and those people I was hanging out with who were my peers, same age as I am, they weren't drinking and partying the way I wanted to, and having this exposure to these older people, my sister's friends and other older people I got to know, became a little more advanced. So I find myself, actually at that point, about 15, every day after school, had a friend who was a couple years older than I am, but he was pretty, physically, he was a pretty big guy, and had facial hair, 15 or 16, and we'd go to the country store, and he'd buy a six-pack of beer, Mickey's or something like that, and every day after school, we would just drink and carry on, and then we would walk the train tracks to town and find somebody to buy us liquor if we were lucky, if we'd get there by 6 p.m., and, you know, we would just drink, and I, you know, during this, it's all sort of a blur a little bit because, you know, I have no idea. I have kids today. I have three daughters now. And I have no idea what my parents were thinking or doing. And they certainly are not the type of people that just turn the kids loose and let them go. So only thing I can really chalk it up to is I was burning the candle at both ends. I was leading a double life, you know. By day, I was going to school, and I was somehow or another still doing my work, getting decent grades, you know, so that I wasn't noticed. But then in the evenings, it was, you know, I was partying, you know, every day. And, of course, that progressed. And as the years went on, you know, the next couple of years, 15, 16, 17, 18, I became less and less interested in, you know, doing what I'm supposed to be doing, like going to school and athletics. I mean, growing up, I was, you know, very involved in sports and played soccer, you know, 7, 8, 9 years for a long time. And then around that time, at 13, 14, 15, I gave up everything. I didn't really have interest in, you know, chasing girls as much, you know, as long as it was convenient, you know, I would chase girls. But if it came down to like partying or a girlfriend, the girlfriend had to go, you know, so nothing interfered with my drinking and partying. And, in the process, I was very self-centered, manipulative. I'm trying to put this in general terms here, but I was very lazy, you know, as a person. You know, it was too much work to try to actually do the right thing and then party too. So I began to look for shortcuts. You know, and a shortcut I found instead of going to work and working 40 hours a week, or I had a part-time job, but, you know, that took a lot of time. It took a lot of time away from my partying. So I found some illegal activities that I could enterprise in that would supplement my drinking and partying. So that's what I did. That's what I was trying to say. So I pursued that with passion and for many years. And I kind of just came to at like 18 years old, 19 years old, and all my friends are going off to college. They're having a good time. They look like they're pursuing, you know, career paths, and some of them that don't go to college are getting married and starting families, and, you know, I'm just partying. You know, it seemed like that's pretty much all there was to do. So I went to this party in Blacksburg, Virginia, and in the Caldwell National Forest. It was basically like a 3-day, it was almost like Woodstock, I guess you could say. And I just fell in love. I was like, man, these are my people. So I enrolled at Virginia Tech. I decided that that was the logical plan of action there for me. So I had no idea. I had an undeclared major, you know. I had several semesters of community college under my belt. I had graduated from community college, and then I enrolled in Virginia Tech. And I went down there, and I just lost my mind. I went down there, as, you know, as alcoholics, I find comparing my story to others, we were very resourceful people. You know, I went down there. I didn't know anybody, not a soul. I knew one guy from high school who lived over in Radford, and I hardly ever talked to him. But by the end of the semester, I got a whole new set of friends, you know, or acquaintances, maybe I should call them. It was just nonstop. It was unsupervised, you know, just have a good time every day, all day, and really talk about burn the candle at both ends, you know, party till 3, 4, 5 in the morning, you know, get 2 hours of sleep, you know, wake up, get to my 8 o'clock class sometimes, you know, and do the best I can. And I always did a really good job at maintaining, you know, I always hit the bare minimum. I always hit the bare minimum requirement. You know, I dodged the bullet. I didn't get on academic probation. You know, I didn't have good grades, but I had grades just good enough that I didn't hit academic probation. And, so I live in this double life, and I got a knock on the door one day as I was in my junior year at school. I was pretty far advanced in my academics, and I got a knock on the door one day, and it was Montgomery County Drug Task Force, and it was about 15 of them. It's like something you see on TV. And guns drawn, battering ram, the whole deal. And they decided that they didn't like my source of income. And they came in. That was like the beginning. That was the unraveling for me. That's where it began right there. And, you know, I had to say, just to back up a little bit, I'll tell you about, you know, I could go on for more than an hour talking about, you know, the DWI that got dropped to a reckless charge, all the times that I'm pitching things out the window on the back road as I see the blue lights coming from a distance. You know, I can go on for a while and talk to you about the, you know, the sordid places I would go and the people I would hang out with. And I can tell you that I just kept lowering my standards, you know. I couldn't lower my standards as fast as I was hitting them, you know, and it kept going down and down and down. And in the end, you know, I really didn't have any, I don't want to say friends. I certainly didn't have any friends. I had a group of people that surrounded me who we had a mutual relationship. I got something from them. They got something from me, you know, on many different levels. And that's kind of how I existed at that point. And I went through this legal experience, for me at that moment, I really felt like the walls had just fallen in. You know, I felt like, okay, this is it. Because I'd been doing the living two lives very, very well up until that point, and this was sort of like the veil, you know, just got drawn, and now all of a sudden I was really concerned, you know, rightfully so, that I wasn't going to be able to finish my college, you know. And I always kind of, somewhere in the back of my mind, I thought to myself, you know, I'm just doing this now. I'm just having a good time, and eventually I'll get my stuff together. You know, eventually I'm going to get my act together. I'm going to have a family and kids and the white picket fence and the house. I mean, that's kind of what was in the back of my mind, but I look at it now, I certainly wasn't taking any actions, you know, towards that sort of path, you know. So there was really no chance of me ever getting there on the road I was on. So this all went down, and it's really serious. They were talking 6 to 33 years. They were pretty serious. And I heard from my lawyer that they were looking, his exact words were, they were looking to make an example out of you, and I kind of laughed it off. I had dodged another bunch of legal scrapes. So you write the lawyer a check, and if there's enough zeros, then the charge gets dropped, and then you go home. And that's the way it had always been. So this time, though, he said that they want a pound of flesh. So he was talking about jail time. And his first inclination was they wanted 2 years. So I said, well, that's not going to work. I've got some plans. And I don't think I can do that. And he was like, well, it's really not your choice. Yeah, so, of course, that wasn't good enough, so I went and hired another lawyer. Ironically, I just say this, that anything I had acquired through that lifestyle was immediately consumed by these legal resources. I mean, and then some. That's still what didn't have enough, So if you're considering that career path, I wouldn't recommend it. I look back on that, I had I used to think I wasn't doing anything wrong. I used to really think that, I'm not standing out here on the playground or something like that, peddling to kids or something like that. I used to think like that, and I'm not hurting anybody but myself and those people that I'm engaged with. They're active participants, they're willing participants. I have a completely different opinion of that now, especially now myself having children and having, kind of being on the other side of it. I have a very different opinion, and I take it very seriously. I kind of say it jokingly because it's almost, I realized that had I not gone through that experience, I wouldn't be standing here today. And that's exactly what it took for me, for them to get my attention. And what would happen is I would go through the legal system for the next 3 years. And it wasn't till February 10th, 1999, and I didn't walk into AA until September 1st, actually August 1st of 2001. So between, in those 2 years, I was definitely attempted suicide through overconsumption of alcohol because I had gotten to a point where I was so ashamed of myself and what I had done, and I had obviously given away a lot of good opportunities. I was so ashamed by all that it seemed like my only option was to drink. And when I hung out with people in those environments, I didn't feel judged. We were kind of comrades, in some shape or way or form. And so for the next during that 2 years, I mean, there wasn't a day that went by that I wasn't obliterated, by nighttime. And I was either blacked out, passed out, and there was many days when I would, I was drunk more than one time in a day. I used to consider that a good day. We go football tailgating or something. If you can get drunk by lunchtime, you can, pass out by 3, wake up at 5, and go back at it again for another round. And it's like 2-for-1 deal right there. So I used to think that was a good thing. In this process that happened to me, this legal experience, I look back on it now, the judge who was presiding on circuit court in Montgomery County, Virginia at that time, did me a great favor. A great favor. They let me off. They gave me this. They sentenced me to this detention center. It's like for young males, like you see on TV, like one of these boot camp programs. And in exchange for 5 years, they were going to let me do this 20-week boot camp program, which is a really sweet deal for being in that predicament. And of course, I just at that point. I was just out of control. And, the best thing probably could have happened, then I don't know that I'd be here today, but, looking back on it, they probably should have just locked me up, but they let me. I had been out on my own recognizance, and they left me out. And, I took that like a permission slip I went on tour, all these concerts and, for like 2 months. And I lost my mind. I showed up there. and had violated some terms and conditions, and had set out, you know, you need to be in this condition when you get here, and I wasn't in that condition. And I went back, and of course that was violated my the agreement. I went back in front of the judge, and he gave me 2.5 years of my 5. And then I 2 days later, he called my lawyer. I don't know how many times this, I think this probably happens in the legal system. He called my lawyer to tell my lawyer that he thinks that he was a little bit too hard on me. And, you know, at that time, I'm just like, you know, it's about time he realized. You know. I mean, that was probably my, you know, as hard-headed as I am, that's probably was my, you know, there's no humility. Nothing existed. And, you know, I look back on it, it was the grace of God working in my life. And 1 year is what I ended up serving. And at the end of that, I had conceded myself, okay, I have a problem. I said, well, it's not alcohol related. It's these other things I was doing. And I was convinced of that. So, and really the reason I was convinced of that is because I couldn't imagine life without some form of help. And, you know, drinking and drugging was the only help that I knew. It was the only thing that made me feel okay, made me fit in, made me have any kind of enjoyment or entertainment out of life. And so I got out of it. I went back to drinking. It seemed like a logical path, you know. I'm just going to have a few. And a few became a few more and a few more. And 30 days out, I'm in Charlottesville one night. Yeah, after getting in a fight in a bar and coming home drunk and a DUI, there I am again. I go through this whole process. So I, at that point, I was really that was the final straw really for me right there. That was the jumping off place, like it talks about in the big book. You know, I was there and I knew loneliness and I knew despair like I had never felt before, because I felt like any opportunity I had been given was about, you know, the carpet was about to get yanked out of me. I mean, he told me when I went back in front of him prior, he said, you know, you, his exact words were, you know, you disgust me, as he's looking down over his glasses, and he said, you know, you've been given a lot of opportunities in life and you've blown them all. You know, and that's exactly how I felt. On the inside. That was a perfect summary of how I felt on the inside, you know. And I felt like a horrible person because I had been given things, you know, opportunities, chances in life that looking back on, I don't know if I deserved them or not. I was given them, you know, and they were blessings to me. And I didn't take advantage of them, and or I didn't capitalize on them. Today, I say that, you know, these are just necessary things that had to happen in order for me to make it to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't have any regret whatsoever about the life I live, because it's brought me right here to this point today. And I have a life, my sponsor says, I have a life second to none. You know, I have a life better than I could ever imagine as a result of going through those things. And I know, had I not gone through those things, I'm the type of person who lacks humility and discipline and patience, I don't know that it would have gotten my attention the way it did. So in this process of second round of legal troubles, I reached out to the local probation office, actually, and went down there, told my story to this guy. I was there. I was sick. I detoxed for about 4 days. I didn't realize I was detoxing. I just laid in on a couch at my mom and dad's house. I had no place to go coming right out of prison. I had no place to go. So I just laid on a couch in my mom and dad's basement in a dark room for about 4 days, sweating, headache, you know, throwing up. And I had no idea. I just was sick. And I thought it was depression, you know. And so I called this guy up. Finally, after 4 days, I knew if I didn't call them, they were going to come look for me. You know, I mean, the authorities. So, because obviously, getting a DUI while you're on probation after serving prison sentence is frowned upon in most states. So I call this guy, make an appointment. I go in. They say, "What's the problem?" And I said, "Well, I just need to talk to somebody in person." What's this pertaining to? And the first time ever in my life, and it didn't even sound like my words, but I think I have a problem with drugs and alcohol. Well, that was an understatement. You know, I think I have a problem. You know, I definitely had a problem. And I went and told my story to this guy, and I thought pretty certain myself that I kind of threw it out there on the table. I knew I had to be honest. Something was telling me that I needed to be honest. Threw it out on the table. And I was pretty certain when I got done, he was going to say, you know, stand up, turn around, and put these handcuffs on you. This is where I thought we were headed. And he just nodded in agreement. He said, "I understand." And he was 19 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, "Would you consider going to AA meeting?" Oh, yeah, I mean, I'm not a dumb guy. You know what I mean? He's giving me another option. And I got another angle out, you know. Oh, yeah. I go to an AA meeting, and would you consider going to a treatment program? That one kind of stumped me. You know, he said, "Oh, you're not that bad yet." Oh no, I'll go. I'll go. Yeah, I'll go. So there I was on my path to Boxwood, right out here on 29. I got a chain link fence around it now with weeds growing up around it. It's not pretty, and it wasn't pretty then. It's pretty dirty. And I got my state-issued big book, you know, courtesy of the Probation and Parole Department. And I can tell you that it means as much to me as though I would have gone to one of these nice treatment centers and paid $30,000 for it. You know, so I'm a firm believer that when you arrive, if you're ready, it will work. And it doesn't matter where you go. It doesn't matter what treatment center you go to. And I'm not knocking one or the other. I'm not saying a state issue big book is better than a $30,000 big book. They're the same. It's the same message. It's the big book. So I plugged into AA is what happened. And, you know, call it happenstance or good fortune, but I got surrounded with a good group of people. And I mean, I really think I was thinking earlier today, you know, that's a big part of the reason that I'm here is because I was surrounded with people. And I got a sponsor who told me, he wasn't nice at all. He wasn't nice to me at all. He told me, he was about 6'6", what, 260 pounds, and he towered over top of me, and I was a little bit intimidated by him. And he used to yell at me and tell me, you know, "You're going to get drunk, you know. You don't do these steps. You don't stick to this thing, you know. You're going back to where you came from." Now, it took me a while to realize that the problems I was having prior to coming to AA were actually related to alcohol. You know what I mean? I just couldn't see the connection. I was a little bit slow when I got here, a little fogged. And but what I can tell you is, as I like the way another friend put it, not every time I drank I got in trouble, but every time I got in trouble I was drinking, you know. That is a true part of my story. And so anyway, he told me things. He was like, you know, the very first thing he said to me, he asked me two questions. You know, first one was, "Can you follow directions?" Yeah, I can follow directions. I got a college degree, you know, don't you know? And the second one was, "Are you willing to go to any length to stay sober?" I said, I don't know about that, you know. I didn't even know that alcoholism was my problem. I had legal problem when I got to AA. I didn't have an alcohol problem. Alcohol was part of my solution plan, you know. And like I said, it took me a little while to connect the dots that alcohol was my problem. And it talks about in the big book that, you know, our drinking is but a symptom of a real condition. You know, we have to get down to those causes and conditions. It talks about in the fourth step, you know, we have to eliminate those things before we can really have that recovery that it talks about. So, you know, in the early goings, you know, my AA life was just go to meetings. Go to meetings. It was his answer for every question I had was go to a meeting, you know. And I wasn't hearing a lot of wisdom and insight about my life at meetings. I was just going to meetings, you know, and I was concerned with just not drinking. I mean, that was a big deal for me. You know, just not drinking was a huge deal. And in the beginning, I felt like I stayed sober 5 minutes at a time. And I sat on my hands, and it was 9 months when somewhere around 8 or 9 months, I remember I had gone the whole day and I hadn't thought about taking a drink. And I remember that it was pretty significant to me. Like that was like a spiritual moment at that point in time. I remember, you know, being consciously aware that I made it through a whole day and I actually didn't think about drinking. And I called my sponsor to tell him that, and he congratulated me and probably said, go to a meeting, you know. And I mean, I just, you know, I got in the back pocket of these people, good people, you know, and he was from Herndon, and he was well connected with AA there and also in this area. And we would just go, that's what we did. We just go Friday night. He's like, what are you doing? And, well, I'm thinking about going to see what old Johnny's doing. I ain't seen Johnny. No, you're not. You're going to an AA meeting. We're going to Chantilly. I'm going to pick you up tomorrow. You know, we'll be there at 6 o'clock. And we would just do road trips all over. And my first year in AA, I went to about 10 conventions, different AA conventions everywhere, all over the state, some in the state, some out of the state. And a really important part of my sobriety was 14 days without a drink. He said, we're going to a men's roundup. I don't know what that was. And he said, well, don't worry about it. He said, all right, hey, we've got you covered. You don't need any money. So I didn't have a good thing. I didn't have a job. And he said, you know, we'll pick you up. And we're going for the weekend up to West Virginia. It's a men's roundup. I thought, okay. I said, we're going to hike or fishing or what are we going to do? Do I need to bring my fishing poles or anything? No, don't worry about it. We got all that. So it was a men's spiritual retreat. Matt Talbot, spiritual retreat. And I found God up there is what happened. And, you know, I don't know that I've ever really contemplated God or the definition of God as an adult prior to coming to AA. And there they told me some things. You know, they're like, it's okay if you want to be if you're angry at God. That's what the guy who had a lot of to me, he had a lot of spiritual wisdom, I thought. He said, it's okay if you're angry with God. He said, in order to be angry with somebody, you must first have a relationship with them. Okay, that kind of took me back. So I could identify with the anger, because I was very angry. I was angry with my life. I had angry with my own choices, decisions I had made. I was angry. My sponsor told me to go to so many meetings, and just full of anger. And you know, there I really felt connected in a way that I had not felt connected prior to going to the retreat, even in AA. And you know, I still go to those, and this is not making a plug for Matt Talbot's spiritual retreats, but I still go to those retreats. And when I go, it's a group of guys there from all over the state. And I only see these guys sometimes one or two times a year. And when we go, it's like we pick up right where we left off, you know. And that's, to me, that's the definition of a true friend today. You know, I know that I've got a couple friends left from my life prior to coming in AA that when I call them and I haven't talked to them for a year and a half, we pick up right where we left off, you know, and we catch up, you know. And I know that, like, they really have my best interests at heart, you know, and I really have their best interests at heart, you know. And that's how that's what I found is my experience here in AA. You know, I don't feel that I've ever really been steered incorrectly in AA in an intentional manner. You know, I've heard some crazy advice given through the years, you know, and now I try to stick with somebody who has experience and not advice, you know. And if ever somebody asks me to help them walk through the steps, I don't want to give anybody my opinion of the steps or my advice on the steps. I can only share with them my experience. And that's something that the group of guys I hung out with initially really instilled in me early on. You know, my sponsor did not have the legal problems that I did, you know. And so, but there was a guy he sponsored who did 3 years in a federal prison. And he said, well, I can't help you with that, but Don can. And we're going to have lunch tomorrow with Don. And you're going to talk to Don about how to stay sober in prison. And I'm like, I don't know this, because I was facing more time coming into AA. And I said, I don't want to talk to Don about staying sober in AA. In prison. I just want to not be in prison. You know, that was my goal. And I guess God had other plans for me. I did end up having to give him a little bit of penance. I ended up with 2 weeks, 15 days. I had to go back and serve when I was 4 months sober for that DUI. And I'll tell you what, that 15 days was longer than the year that I served prior. And the difference was my perception. You know, it was no longer them and the man and... And if I wouldn't have made that left turn, I should have gone down the right way instead of turning left at the stop sign. And I wasn't playing that game anymore, because AA taught me to take responsibility for my actions. And I knew that it was me and my choices for the reason why I'm sitting in there and just being surrounded with all these people talking about the man. And, you know, if I would have gone left and not right, if I wouldn't have drank that last beer, and just listening to that for 15 days was just terrible. It was punishment of its own. So that's why my friend and I, we like to take a meeting into jail today. And it gives me a great feeling when I can sit there. And I also feel like when you have an experience and you share it with somebody, if their reply is, well, that doesn't apply to me, it really doesn't work. Like, I've been to jail, and now I'm sober, and I know that AA works, so they can't sit there in jail and tell me that it won't work for them. Because I know it's not true. It's just simply not true. It will work. If you follow the instructions that are outlined in this book, and you take some suggestions, you humble yourself, and you ask for help, you can be sober. And it's pretty, you know, there's an old timer used to say it's a simple program for complicated people, you know, and I'm a complicated person. I like to louse this thing up, you know, and it really is not that complicated in design. In application, it's much more difficult on a daily basis, I think. I want to just talk about, I've been a little bit back and forth with my story, but I really want to spend some time talking about, you know, what life's like today. You know, important thing to understand is that I've been through this book the message I would make sure that is conveyed is I've been through the book with a sponsor. I've worked the steps. I've written a fourth step. I've gone forward. I've asked God to remove the defects of character that I have and I still have. And then I proceeded on to make amends. And many of those amends that I made, I've restored relationships, old relationships in life, like with my parents, you know, or trusted friends, you know. Some of the amends I made, I've severed relationships with those people, you know. Life changes, and I don't have an ongoing relationship with some of those people on my amends list, first amends list. And, in the process of, to me, I think that the amends process is extremely important. I found that I learned more about me through listening to what others actually said. My sponsor gave me, you know, his advice was about making amends, pray, tell them why you're there, what you think you've done to harm them, and then shut up and listen. And it was the shut up and listening that I really gained insight on who I was and how I really affected people. And, you know, in many cases, there was people that I thought I had done a lot of harm to that didn't perceive it that way at all. And then there's other people that I really didn't think I had done a lot of harm to that were deeply hurt by my drinking, drugging, my selfishness, you know, my character defects. You know, and it's paying attention to those things that really have given me insight on who I don't want to be, who I was when I got here, and who I don't want to be today, because I certainly don't want to be the type of person that is hurtful to others. I don't think anybody aspires to be that. I can tell you that if you drift from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, if you pull away from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and by that I mean not in meetings. I went to meetings. I maintained the level of meetings nearly almost that I go to now, which is 4 to 5 meetings a week. I was still attending 4 to 5 meetings a week, but at 5 years sober, I was just crazy, just insane. And I had, you know, I wasn't practicing these principles in all my affairs, for sure. You know, I had been through the steps. I had a spiritual awakening. I was not drinking. I was attending a lot of meetings, but I was insane. And I came to a gentleman finally after about a year, and I had to get a new sponsor. I had a bad relationship with my old sponsor. I was working for him. It was not a good situation. It was not a healthy situation. And we went to the beginning, and we flipped it over to the preface. And we started right there. And we met at 7 a.m. Every Saturday morning. And that later has become now my home group, the 7 a.m. any length meeting. You know, ironically, you know, it's called the Any Length Group. Meets at 7 a.m. in Culpeper. And that's the same question my first sponsor told me. Are you willing to go to any length to stay sober? And, you know, going through that process a second time, you know, I went through the steps the first time with my first sponsor. I kind of thought, you know, I got my AA diploma. You know, I had the spiritual experience. I'm good. Thank you. I'm going to go to a lot of meetings now, and I'm going to be okay. Well, that doesn't work for me. It does maybe for some people. It didn't work for me. And I do things very different now, you know. My thought process probably isn't a whole lot different, but how I react to those thoughts and, you know, on a daily basis and how I try to conduct myself in situations and relationships with others is very different. And the reason it's different is because I try to stay really connected to what it says in that book. And I try to share my experiences with people like myself, like-minded individuals, and we try to stay really close to what I call the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which to me is the application of the 12 steps, you know. And I need every part of this program. I'm not one of these people that says, the only thing about the program is the 12 steps. Well, I need the 12 steps. That's true. That's the recovery for me. That's where it says recovery on the coin. And the other two sides are service and unity. You know, I need all three aspects of this program working in my life in combination in order for me to have a happy and useful life today. And, you know, service is huge. You know, just going to the jail and making coffee, you know, and I've had a number of service commitments in AA, and I've had service commitments also outside of AA for other organizations, you know, as well. And I view it, you know, it's really, for me, it's about being helpful to others without expectation of reward, you know, and I mean, to me, that's how I view service. You know, and it's really important. We were talking in the meeting prior. It's really important, however, to work with another alcoholic directly. And so I don't want to just become a really busy individual in my community, become the T-ball, you know, coach of the year, and, you know, forget about where it is I came from. You know, I was taught also in AA that, you know, the way I repay the gratitude that I have for being sober is that I give back to AA directly. And I feel like I feel like I could never repay what was given to me. You know, and people took time, people gave up their time, they shared holidays with me, they invited me over for Christmas and Thanksgiving, and you know, when I had nothing, AA was there for me. And the people, specifically, the people of AA were there for me. And that's the unity. You know, that's what we do. You know, some days it's my turn to row in the boat, and other days I'm too tired to row. You know, and I like that analogy. You know, we're like, persons that were on a sinking ship. You know, we're in a rowboat. We're doing this thing together. And I think that, common thread we have really binds us together, so that we really do have our best interests of our fellows in mind, you know, one another. And the friends that I have in AA today, I can't even put it in words, the joy, the pain, the sorrow, you know, it's the whole range of emotions. You know, AA has taught me how to live. AA has taught me how to be, a son, a father, a husband, a friend, an employee. Everything that I have, I feel like I owe to AA. And, it all started with that broken guy that walked in here in 2001, and I thought my life was over, you know. And I heard that, you know, when you're laying on your back, you're looking in the right direction, you know. And that's where I was, you know, when I got here. I was at the bottom as far as I'm concerned. I don't want to go any further. And I do know that, you know, I'm not impervious to a drink. You know, I know that. I know that I don't want to say anybody can drink. I wouldn't say that. You know what I mean? I don't want to drink today. That's what I'm trying to say. I think there's a good chance that if I do tomorrow what I try to do today, I think there's a good chance that I won't want to drink tomorrow either. I don't know. Tomorrow hasn't gotten here yet, and I'm just still sticking with today, you know. But if you live every day right, then today never ends. You know, it's like forever. I would be remiss if I didn't at least say something about. I'm running short on time, but I want to say something about the family that I have today. I could go on for another hour probably talking about my family, but I have a wife and three daughters, two of which came into my life in sobriety. They were 3 and 7, and I was frightened to death of this woman and her two children. This is a huge commitment, you know, and I didn't take it lightly. You know, I didn't take it lightly at all that I was going to be impacting these children's lives. You know, I didn't take that at all. I took that as a charge of responsibility. And, they're 19 and 15 today. And they call me Dad. The 19-year-old still gets on my lap, throws their arms around me and hugs me. And I had a friend who told me, he said, and then we had a child together who's 10. And I had a friend tell me, he said, you know, you'll look back on it in your life. And he said, that'll be the best thing you've ever done. Have those kids. And I can tell you that is the best thing I've ever done. My children have taught me more about sobriety, I think, than some of the meetings I go to, you know, because I come home, I'm a spiritual giant, I come home from this weekend men's retreat, and I say one little thing to my 10-year-old, and, you know, she's in tears, and all of a sudden I realize that I'm not doing as well as I think I am. You know, and that's how, for me, that's how this thing works, you know. If I think I'm doing pretty well, I'm probably not, you know. I have to keep seeking. You know, I have to keep looking for it. I have to keep plugging away, just chipping at it, you know. I like the analogy in, I think it's a daily meditation. It talks about the miner with the belt drawn in over his last notch, you know. He finally strikes gold. And he realizes that the only way that he can keep that gold if he continuously gives away all of his profits, you know. And it's like a river that has to continue to flow. And if it becomes dammed up, it becomes stagnant. And if it continues to flow, it's fresh and it's clean, it's new. And my life today is, I can't even put it in words how wonderful it is. And all the blessings that I've been given. And all the things that I thought would never happen to me that I wasn't capable of acquiring have happened, and then a lot more. And so if you're new here or you're not having a good time here at this moment in your life, just hang in there. You know, if you hear nothing else, just hang in there. This time takes time, and it's painful sometimes, but it's worth it in the end. Thank you again.